Go ahead, please.
Yeah. Can you hear me all right, Paul?
Yeah.
I can't see it occurring, to be quite honest with you, for two particular reasons. You did mention one of them, and that is meeting needs, right? There'll be a transition period, I agreed, on meeting human needs. But that transition period itself will mean that we'll be using quite a bit more energy, right, to meet these needs. The other thing that is going to cause big problems is the cleanup of capitalism. Social society will not be happy or contented with the pollution that's occurring in capitalism, etc. And also the loads and loads of empty buildings, etc., and industries. I mean, I got in my own area, we've got a blight on a community with a old coke works that's been emptied out for 20 years or more, right? And nothing's going to occur because it's so unprofitable to clean up the area. It costs money, right? In capitalist terms, that won't occur in socialism. But at the same time, in order to clean up those types of areas, we're going to use a hell of a lot of energy, right? And that is a good impact on growth. You know, that's going to cause growth to go ahead, as far as I can see. I think those are the two main problems that I can think of at the present moment.
Yeah, I agree. The problem is not so much what would a kind of full-scale socialist society look like. It's what do we do in the initial phases of socialism, and how long will those last? And I don't think we can really answer that now. We don't know precisely what the problems will be. We just need to be aware that they exist. As you say, they may well need to be a much larger expenditure of energy to begin with, just to clear up the mess of capitalism, and also to bring much of the so-called third world up to the level of more developed countries. Yeah, I agree. And in those situations, talk about degrowth is getting the wrong end of the stick, I think. But nevertheless, after the transition period, then I agree there are lots of problems to encounter first. Howard. Oh, sorry, Paddy, is that you first? Sorry.
Yeah, but
I think
Paddy,
Howard was first.
Was he? Okay.
Yeah.
I don't mind you going first, Paddy.
I was just going to make a quick point that just following from what Brian just said is that I think what's when it comes to sort of cleaning up after capitalism, a lot of what we, you know, the socialist society would do is pretty easy, actually. It's just simply stop doing stuff. It's stop doing the things that capitalism is doing to ruin the planet, the environment in the first place. I mean, just to take one example, when the huge oil leak happened in the Gulf of Mexico, I don't know if people know this, and it was thought that this would destroy sort of wildlife in the Gulf. In fact, it recovered massively despite the oil, because what happened was the fishing stopped for about 10 years, and fish stocks rebounded massively in that time. And all so, you know, the lesson from that is, if you want the oceans to recover, stop destroying them, stop plundering them constantly, you know, for fish, which a large amount of fish is just for animal feed, by the way, and this sort of feeds into the sort of whole, you know, reduced meat diet that kind of makes so much sense that it's UN standard policy now. So, you know, just a general point, a lot of stuff we wouldn't have to do anything. We just have to stop doing stuff. So there you go. That was a simple point.
Okay, thanks. Howard.
Yeah, Paul, there is another book you could have mentioned, which you obviously know because you did a review of it for The Standard 2 or 3 months ago, and that's the book called Half Earth Socialism, which, so people can see it on the screen, by Vitese and Pendergrass, two American writers, two American academics. And they are advocates of degrowth, and in fact of degrowth socialism, not degrowth capitalism. What they advocate is very much what we advocate, moneyless, non-market society, etc. They're not exactly the same as us in every respect, but very similar, it must be said. In fact, what happened is that Paul and I both read this book independently without knowing the other person was reading it, and we both submitted reviews to The Standard for it, and the editors, not knowing what to do in the end, decided to publish both. They published Paul's review under reviews because it was review length. Paul had managed to sort of, you know, cut it down sufficiently, been sufficiently concise. I'd been more long-winded, so what I wrote they made into a longer article with and they both sort of referenced each other. And we actually said quite similar things. I think I was a bit more sort of positive than Paul was on the whole, but quite similar. And I'm mentioning this because as a result of that, we contacted one of the authors and came to an agreement that that author would do a question and answer for The Standard, which is actually going to be published, I understand, in this coming month's, in the July Socialist Standard. But I can give you a bit of a preview because I've seen his answers. In fact, the editors, I think, are going to do a sort of postscript to the answers, which are, you know, pretty good from our point of view as well. But there is a particular question which pertains to degrowth and a particular answer which I think it might be sort of, I've actually got it. I've got a copy of it because I was the one who communicated with it, with this writer to sort of get his answers. And I can just perhaps read it because I think it is relevant to this discussion. People will remember this was the Standard that had the original, the articles by Paul and myself in March. But I can't show it on the screen, but I can. It's relatively short, but I can read out what Drew Pendergrass, one of these authors, says in response to a specific question. I've got it here somewhere. Right. The question that we put, the Socialist Standard put, you describe the common idea, you being this the author, you describe the common idea that the Earth is overpopulated as dangerously exaggerated. So they're anti sort of myth of overpopulation, which is good. But wouldn't some say that there are too many people for the resources that the Earth, even in a non-market society, could make available to give everyone a decent, comfortable life? That's the question. His response is, and I'll just read you sort of extracts from the response, not the whole thing, because it's several paragraphs long. But he says, one of the exercises we follow in the book is to imagine what it would take to provide the material basis for human flourishing to 10 billion people, a fair bit more than live today, while staying within planetary boundaries. We make the point that both sides of this equation, what a comfortable life means and where exactly planetary boundaries lie, are political questions that can only be answered by reference to values. And he goes on to say, the trick is what you mean by comfortable. If you mean US levels of energy and material use, then you will be dissatisfied by our proposal. Instead, we propose energy quotas and a change in diet towards veganism for most people. And then he goes on to say, if I can find it, he says, I'll just read his final paragraph on this. It's quite a bit more detail, actually, in this response. But he says, a life with no meat, fewer flights, smaller homes, limited cars, and reduced consumption may seem intolerable for some, but that does not mean that such a life isn't comfortable. Guaranteed housing, health care, and education in a built environment that prioritizes sharing and community sounds luxurious to me. Now, this isn't something that the party shares in its sort of overall policy, because what the authors do in their book is they try to go into far more detail about what a non-market society would be like than we would dare to do. In fact, they say quite openly that they do want to write recipes for the cookshops of the future. They do say that, you know, the Marx's famous phrase. In those circumstances, you know, they need to get into what would be possible and what wouldn't in their in their opinion. But you know, just to say that there are people, as it were, on our side, but who would like to be far more prescriptive than we are about precisely what we can expect, the kind of abundance, if you like, we can expect to enjoy in a socialist society. I'll just say one more thing as well. When I first got to know the party, believe it or not, in 1970, the Standard had an issue which some of you may remember. It was August 1970 Socialist Standard, and this was the front page, if people can see it. Okay, a bit different from today's Standard, isn't it? Slightly less elaborate. That was what the Standard was like then, a world of abundance, it said. And there was a succession of very good articles in it about how socialism could provide abundance. One was entitled Capitalism, Waste, Want. Another one was called Progress Perverted. That's a classic, actually, Progress Perverted. I think it was the late lamented Ron Cook who wrote that. Another one was Not Too Many People, an article against the idea of overpopulation, and a key article entitled The World Can Feed Us All. And there's even an article entitled A Framework for Socialism, World Administration. It goes into a bit more detail than we normally would about how socialism might be run, might be organised, but okay, nothing wrong with that. So this sort of discussion has been going on for a long time. And at that time, I don't think the party would have wanted anyone to suggest that there wouldn't be sort of absolute abundance for everyone, and everyone could have more or less everything that they well, everything that they could reasonably need, they could reasonably want. Whereas I think it's a bit more equivocal now. I think it's a bit less sort of clear cut, given the climate crisis and the way resources, capitalism has squandered resources and is causing the earth to quake anyway, put it like that. So, yes, so there we are, just a sort of word about the kind of thing that we're saying at the present, and also the kind of thing that we said what 50 years ago.
Yeah, I'm too young to remember that Standard, but I think I did make the point that was again made from the meeting last week that we don't really talk about abundance as much as we used to do, and the question I've sometimes used is an effective abundance, not, you know, masses of whatevers, but, you know, enough of whatevers. And in terms of recipes for the future cookshops, again, another expression I've sometimes used is the idea of a feasibility study, where you look at what might be feasible in a future society, where you need to make some assumptions and you say what would be feasible on the basis of those assumptions. I think that's a good way of looking at it, and maybe that's what Battese and Pendergast, whatever the names are doing there, even if sometimes they go a bit over the top in being a bit too specific. Yeah. Okay. Andy Davis, please.
Oh, thanks, Paul. That was a great talk. You made some very, pertinent points in quite a concise way, really. This idea about which perhaps we all know about anyway, but you drew upon the spirit level book. I read that book a few years ago, and the idea about equality versus ownership, equality in any given society or any given community is a far more effective harbinger of happiness than inequality and some people having more wealth than others. And it was great that you touched on the point about power tools. I got into a right lot of trouble about a while ago anyway, and I've reflected upon this because I'm a great fan of power tools, and I've got a few in my garage, and I love to get them out, and they're sort of like toys for me, really, in a way. But I also thought about the way that in socialism we'd have, like, the way we have libraries now, for books, or we used to have, at least, who knows what the situation will be when socialism is actual. But you'd have a tool bank, that's the sort of way to look at it. All that stuff about planned obsolescence and the unnecessary sort of way that farming is currently practiced, etc., with animals as well, was very good. The only thing that I sort of would like to perhaps just make a kind of problematic point about is that when we talk about, maybe before I make my problematic point, can I also say I completely I'm in line with the, I think it was the, it was the standard quote in 2022 that, after, the democratic revolution for libertarian socialism, then there probably will be, I would hope anyway, a massive ramping up of production for a while to ensure that things get equalized across the planet. Now, I know some people will say, well, that's going to harm the environment and so on. But I also come back to the sort of the pre-environmentalist sort of era, really, where abundance was the condition, and it still is. Socialism is oven baked because we live in a world of abundance. It's just that it's rationed abundance, as we all know. But listen, like most of us, I live in a fairly ordinary community. If you go out onto Walsall High Street or West Bromwich High Street or Bilston Market and try to tell people that they need to reduce their consumption in some ways, from a party perspective, and from a sort of making the case perspective, you're on a loser from the start. All I'm really trying to suggest is that we just have to be careful about how we couch this stuff. Not to say that I think it's incredibly important, but just to be careful about how we talk about these issues about growth and about consumption by individuals. I am perfectly content if I feel secure and have all the basic needs met and have friends and family and comrades and just everything else. But a lot of people people feel very insecure in life because that's the way capitalism has made them feel. I feel like that a lot of the time. So I'm just trying to say that we just have to be careful how we present these arguments for the party. Thanks.
I remember a few years ago reading something which said that on average American women only wear 25% of the clothes in their wardrobe in any year. That's throughout the whole year. That's not because they don't wear their winter clothes in the summer or whatever. And I've asked a few women in Manchester about this, and their response has been to say, no, it's nowhere near that amount in my case, hope they're being honest. I mean, there are some things we have far too many. I mean, I'm sure lots of people have far too many pairs of shoes and this kind of thing, but in terms of what really matters in terms of basic material security, I mean, growing enough food for everybody would be, well, I think straightforward would be the word I'd use, not easy. I mean, I think most agricultural experts would agree that enough could be grown now to feed everybody. Of course, it's not, because it's not profitable to do so and so on. Yeah. So from that point of view, yes, there would need to be an increase in what was produced, but it would be perfectly doable and so on. Yeah. Mocky, please.
Hello. Yes, I do agree. We do have to be very careful about how much stuff we buy, but I've got a particular gripe about appliances. Any appliance you buy, you are being conned, because all appliances are made with a limited life, so that you've got to keep buying new ones all the time. And I've had a particular gripe about this just recently, because my electric kettle broke down. Of course, it was just after the guarantee had run out. And when I took it to the repair place, they said, oh, it can't be repaired, because they're made in such a way that they can't be repaired anymore. So you have to chuck it out and get a new one. And it's not just electric kettles, it's all appliances. So I wrote a letter of complaint about it and said that I wasn't complaining just about the kettle, but about capitalism in general, that forces manufacturers to produce substandard products so that we've got to keep buying new ones all the time. And in fact, I sent this to another comrade who has expanded it to make it into a suitable length article to submit to the Standard. So it will be going in, I think, in the July one. So it's all very well as trying to be careful and saying, oh, we don't need to buy this, we don't need to buy that. So I've sort of come to the conclusion that if I don't buy another electric kettle, if I buy a stainless steel cooking pot, that should last me forever. But the fact is, it costs more money to cook a pot of water on the cooker than it does to boil a kettle. So you can't win either way. Right, that's all I've got to say on it. Thank you.
I don't want to talk about electric kettles. Mine stopped working a few weeks ago as well, but I did go and buy a new one. Yeah. Okay. Freddie, please.
Yes, thanks. And, in line with what others were saying there, yeah, I enjoyed that talk, Paul. And yeah, lots of food for thought. And similarly, like Howard mentioned, although I didn't go back as far as that, I did look up some old standards that I have, and the one that I've got is from May 1977. So not just as far back as Howard's, but that was it there. And I don't know if you can see it at all. Well, I know you can see where it says social standard, but at the bottom there, it talks about energy sources for socialism. And this was an article by a chap called Tony, where it talks about alternative energy, fuel for thought. So it's clearly something that the party has been dealing with for many, many years, and how we look at it. And you know, what new developments that there will be over the years. I mean, there's recently been programmes on, and I think Paddy made the point a little bit earlier, where about the oil spill, etc. Well, I so happened to be watching a programme about the environment the other night there, about coral reefs. But this was in the sort of Bermuda, Jamaica, etc. Area of the world, where the coral reefs were being damaged, and then those activists of people getting engaged and seeking to have these areas of sort of natural beauty protected, etc., and they're recovering again now. So some of the damage that's currently been done within capitalism, where steps are taken to try and reverse the damage. Some of them have certainly been successful, and that's no doubt something that we can learn by. But I also appreciated the point that Andrew was making, that we need to be a little bit cautious as to the extent of, well how we explain the production. Yes, there needs to be an abundance of production to feed the world, etc. And that is largely there at this stage also. And the new developments that are taking place, the new experiments that are taking place to grow food in a smaller area, using less energy, etc., using new varieties of vegetables, etc. I found this very interesting. But it's looking at trying to tie up the methods of production that exist as the development of a socialist case spreads even further than what we do at this time. So I think, though, that we could explain, you know, if there are individuals whom are perhaps it's been suggested to that they need to cut back their consumption. It could be explained in such a way, though, that perhaps they wouldn't take umbrage if you were tying it in with that production should be sort of in line with good practices, best practices that are saving the earth, etc. Because if we don't save the earth, we ain't going to be here at all anyway. And life's just going to be much, much more difficult. So I think that is something that the party really needs to consider. And I think finally, I don't think I've mentioned this yet, is that we shouldn't be, and Paul mentioned it, about being too prescriptive at this time as to what socialism would exactly look like. Because as the party goes bigger, as people's consciousness become more aware, I think you know that may well alter the views. So, you know, I don't believe we can do an absolute blueprint for socialism just now, and we need to exercise some caution in how we are portraying the socialist case. Thank you.
Yeah, I suppose one reason why people buy stuff now, why they go on shopping sprees, is because they're feeling a bit miserable and a bit down. That's, you know, the effect of capitalism. That one way to get around that is to go and not to go and buy a new electric kettle, go and buy something anyway, you know, or a few things. And that's the kind of thing which won't be a problem in socialism, I'm sure. Paddy next, please, then John. Paddy.
Just to sort of continue this discussion, I thought it was interesting, Paul, that you said that, you know, the party doesn't have a position on this, despite that interesting quote that you found. It's probably quite a, you know, it's a timely discussion to have, because I think we ought to have a position on this. I mean, it's all very well saying that, you know, don't go and tell people in Walsall that they'll have to do without anything because you're on a loser. But, well, don't tell them about socialism either, because you're probably on a loser there as well. So the fact, you know, and that's true of anywhere, not just Walsall, obviously. But, I mean, even though we don't want to be too prescriptive, as Freddie says, you know, there's no doubt that the Earth does have real limits. There was a study in New Scientist in April that the if you pulled out all the stops, that's it, freed up all the farmland on the planet, took it out of meat production and so on and so forth, you could feed 20 billion people, but you might wreck the planet in the process. So I don't know why exactly they did that study, just to see what the upper limit was. But you know, there are real limits. You can't give everybody a Western lifestyle with the planet that we've got. You'd need two or three planets for that. You know, there are limits. So, and capitalist society itself is having this discussion right now about reducing consumption. You've seen what the United Nations has said repeatedly about this. So it's not as if we would be saying anything outlandish or anything that that ordinary people haven't already been hearing. What we need to do is be part of that conversation. We need to, as Paul was talking about, feasibility studies. We could certainly look into that. We could say what's feasible, what we mean by a feasible, I can't remember your effective abundance, I think you called it, Paul. And I think it's really important that we do that, because otherwise we're going to be going out there either advocating some kind of unattractive hair shirt socialism, or on the other extreme, we're going to be advocating some sort of fabulous but unrealistic cornucopia that makes us look like, you know, Pollyanna fantasists. So if we want to look plausible to people, we have to present a plausible case. And just telling everybody that they can have as much of everything as they want with no restrictions whatsoever, people are just not going to believe it. I mean, would you believe it? So that's my point.
I wonder if we should make less use of the term free access and perhaps say, I don't know, limited access. Well, I'm not sure what to say instead, but John, please, John Cumming.
I don't think I think we're perhaps worrying a bit unnecessarily about this question of abundance. I think in the main people will have abundance, but society can still at the same time, like Paddy said earlier, just not do certain things that are detrimental to the environment, certain things that are detrimental to human beings in terms of alienation and so forth produced by capitalism. The electric kettle was a perfect example, just one of many examples of something that should be easy to repair but has effectively been sabotaged because the capitalists want to sell you another kettle and not waste, from their point of view, anyone's effort on trying to repair things. And that goes with almost anything that you can buy now. And, you know, they basically don't want you to open. They want you to treat everything like a black magic box that they've created for you and sold you. And, you know, goods are not produced with either repairability in mind or upgradability. It's perfectly possible to produce, for example, computers. They do it to a small extent where you can slot in extra memory. Well, you could actually do things in a more planned way and devise machines that you already anticipated how you might need to repair them later on, and you didn't make it so difficult for things to be repaired. So, as I say, as was mentioned earlier, it's just not doing a lot of things that we have been doing because of capitalism. And that accounts for a massive amount of energy. If you think about the amount of energy military aircraft use, all the weaponry that's used in the various wars, even when there's just small wars going on in the world, and then all the wasted work inside capitalism that doesn't produce a single useful thing. The productive forces in this society are tremendously powerful, given that it's only a small section of society that actually is engaged in productive work. I think we could worry ourselves unnecessarily about giving people the wrong idea about socialism, because I think we've always stated that, or it's always been implicit, even if for some it's not explicit, that socialism will be impossible if people have the same mad ideas that they have in capitalism, that, oh, the thing to do is have this wonderful luxury lifestyle and have all the stuff that capitalists have. I mean, most of the stuff that these people have is just to show off, and they destroy things, waste things just because they can. These people, they're the symptom of an abhorrent society that we would hope that people would become sick of and become receptive to socialist ideas instead, and that socialism would still be a world of abundance, more than a lot of people have now, but it could never be unfettered superabundance to the point of you could just have anything you want. You're living in a society, and society has to agree to produce the goods, and society will produce such goods as it thinks fit. And you know, too bad if somebody wants some mad cap product that used to be prevalent amongst capitalists within this horrible system. Tough luck. We'll be producing good stuff that lasts and that people can use for a long, long time. And if and when it does wear out, it won't be something that will be piled up in the ocean in a big pile of plastic that's not biodegradable. I think they said it's as big as some city or some country even. You know, I think we could just worry far too much about, you know, what socialism will be capable of and what it might not be capable of.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for that. Yes. Howard.
Just to follow on from John, I was going to say something really quite similar, but to give an example, I remember when I first got involved with the party and going to meetings and listening to the objections that people had to the ideas that were being put across by members. I remember somebody saying, look, couldn't possibly work. What, for example, if in a socialist society I wanted a rocket to go to the moon? And the answer to that by another member who was very good at answering questions was quite simply, you couldn't have one. You can't have a rocket to go to the moon because that would be totally unreasonable. And, you know, people will not be building rockets to go to the moon. You'll have to do it without your rocket to go to the moon. And another question was, what if there is a blight throughout the world on apple trees? And I'm very, very fond of apples. I can't get apples. What's going to happen then? Clearly, you know, this won't be a society of abundance. And the answer was, well, you'll have to make do with pears, at least in the short term. And this concept of reasonableness, I think, that we have to sort of inject into our argument. You know, socialism will not be a society of superabundance where you can have absolutely anything you happen to want on a whim at a particular time. It will be a society where there will be what you, well, Paul called it effective abundance, reasonable abundance, something like that. The other point I wanted to make was that this issue of, you know, whether the extent to which we should be prescriptive, we shouldn't be over-prescriptive, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we don't want recipes for the cook shops and so on and so forth. And Paul quoted from the article in the
February 2022 standard, which I've just looked at myself actually while we've been talking, and a very good article. I read the quotation that Paul gave from it, and suddenly I was filled with sadness, and I was filled with sadness because I noticed the article, I must have read it at the time, was written by Alan Johnston, who disappeared, who seems to have disappeared from the face of the earth. Alan Johnston, a lot of us knew him. He often came on these sessions, lived somewhere in the Far East. Nobody seemed to quite know where. He frequently wrote very good articles for The Standard. He conducted the Socialism or Your Money Back blog and was incredibly active day in, day out. And he disappeared. Nobody seems to know where he is, if he's anywhere. Made me very, very sad to see his name at the end of this article. Don't know whether anybody here knows anything more about it than I do, but I suspect nobody does. Sorry about that, but, thought it was worth mentioning.
Yeah, absolutely, yes, agreed. Mike Foster.
Thanks, nothing more to say on Alan, yeah, and hopefully there'll be some good news, once we do hear something. excuse me. The point I was going to make, I'm quite sort of pessimistic when it comes to sort of this angle of the party case or ways of arguing for socialism, in that the way I think things will pan out is that by the time there's a wide enough level of class consciousness that would, be a prerequisite for a socialist revolution, by the time that happens, the planet will be in such a depleted state when it comes to the environment, with the environmental damage which is accelerating now. So whatever the state of the environment is in however many decades time, that will shape, the argument about what's feasible and what's realistic, more so than we can sort of usefully say at the moment. Of course, we can sketch things out, but like others have said, we can't afford to be too prescriptive because, the material conditions then will be, much different to how they are now. And to say that will sort of guide the argument then. So I think, maybe we could sort of, well, I don't know, I'm not saying... I was going to say, if we downplay that side of our argument, it might avoid embarrassment. But that's a sort of a chicken's way out. Really, it's best to sort of confront it, isn't it, and come up with a robust argument rather than sort of shying away from one of the more important issues of the time. But like others have said, if we we need to be careful that what we say about abundance doesn't give an unrealistic impression. I suppose it's analogous as well, with our stance of a world without borders. That's something else we need to be sort of careful how we pitch, so that people don't jump to some conclusion and assume that they'd link that in with the sort of the current attitudes towards immigration. And again, that would sort of start a conversation off on the wrong foot, being misinterpreted right from the start. So I think it's analogous to our stance on no borders, which is which again is something we need to sort of argue carefully to avoid being misunderstood. Yeah. Anyway, that's me. Thank you. Cheers.
Andy, please.
The prompt to put the hand up actually was to second Howard's concern about Alan and met Alan several times and I'm a bit shocked about it, to be honest. I didn't realise that potentially the situation's so serious. So I'm sorry, very sorry to hear that. Following up, perhaps, on what I've heard tonight, it's been a very balanced discussion. And I've enjoyed it and taken quite a few points of learning away from it. So I'd just like to thank everybody involved.
Okay, Moggy, please.
Hello. Yes, just continuing this, these thoughts about Alan Johnson and not being able to contact anybody else. A similar thing happened here in New Zealand the end of last year. We lost contact with one of our comrades, and nobody else had an alternative number that we could ring or anyone else we could contact. We didn't know the names of any of his relatives to be able to contact. And it was 4 months before we found out that this chap had actually died. So I suggest...
Hold on. Where is the interference coming?
Right. Shall I go on?
Sorry, that was Danny's iPad.
Oh. Yeah, I was talking to one of the comrades about it the other day, and we decided that it might be a very good idea to give an alternative contact number. So he sent me a couple of different email addresses of relatives so that if I couldn't contact him, I had someone else I could contact. And I said, well, I would do the same. Maybe not everybody wants to make their personal contacts available to other people, but I would be very happy to do so to any of my comrades who, well, certainly the ones who take part in the Friday night chat group. And so I will do that. I will send, well, I'll send an email to Adam and give a couple of other email addresses of people that can be contacted if for any reason any of you couldn't contact me and wonder what the hell had happened to me. There'd be an alternative couple of people that you could contact to ask. So if anyone else feels the same way, I think it would be a jolly good idea, because it's just awful not knowing what's happened to Alan. And of course, you know, we're all sort of thinking the worst now, aren't we? Thank you.
Does anybody have any further contributions on the degrowth topic, please? If so, raise your hand. If not, then shall we draw this meeting to a conclusion? What's the next meeting, Paddy?
Right, I think the next one is me doing what's in the news, I suspect.
Right. Without, and when's that?
It's probably next week, but you might want to check the... hang on, just give me a sec, I'll just find out. I should know, shouldn't I?
If you're doing it, you ought to know, yeah.
I ought to know, shouldn't I, yeah. It's... No, we don't seem to have anything for next week. It's because we haven't published the meetings list for June yet, so... that'll go up in the next few days. So you're going to have to keep your eyes peeled. Does everybody know where Moggy, that problem is still there.
I'll mute. I just want to know, are we having a meeting next Friday night or not?
Yeah, that's what I was just trying to resolve, but I haven't had the meetings list from Adam yet, so that's what I was saying. Does everybody know where the what's on list is on the party website? It's just at the a menu at the top that says what's on. Look in the month calendar.
We just need to look out for it.
Yeah. Mike.
I'd just like to thank you for that meeting, Paul. It's quite an interesting talk.
Okay, good. Thank you.
I think one of the problems we face is the current information that's come out in the last few weeks about climate. I don't think we'll have much chance of doing much. But on that pessimistic note, I'm sorry, but I've been reading too long. Good night.
Perhaps we should add that to the membership questionnaire. Are you an optimist or a pessimist? I don't know what sort of answers we get, you know. John again, please.
Just to counter any note of pessimism, I don't know if this counters it or not, but that article referred to by Howard from 1970, I remember it. I didn't meet the party until the following year, but party members at that time had a lot of back issues of the Standard, which they duly supplied to me. And a lot of these articles, particularly on that theme, I found very, very interesting and were instrumental in me joining the party a few years later. So that's perhaps an optimistic note that we do have something useful to say and has helped some of us.
So Glasgow members aren't as pessimistic as some used to be, from what I recall.
Well,
I'm not naming names, but you know who I mean.
It's difficult to say. Sometimes we have sounded very pessimistic, but we've taken that to mean that we're being realistic rather than too optimistic. It's difficult to. I think we have to be optimistic because no matter how bad things get, you have to at least try while you still live. You have to try to see if we can improve things. If it turns out we can't, then we'll just die no worse than we would have done under capitalism. Capitalism's a filthy, rotten system, and you know, why should we let them have it all their way? Why shouldn't we resist it? And if we fail, I had no illusions when I was 15 that I would never see socialism. I just knew that the people around me weren't the stuff of which revolutions were made. But that hasn't stopped me trying to advance the case for a society that I think will be in everyone's interest. And I would, of course, I've always been pleased to be proved wrong, but the older I get, obviously, the less chance there is of that. But I don't see that as cause for pessimism. So long as there's human beings around, there will be some kind of society, and that society should be one that operates in the interests of everyone.
Thanks, Paddy.
Yeah, just to say, I've just found the meetings list and there is not a meeting on next Friday. I'm doing the news thing for my sins the following Friday.
OK, thanks for that. And thanks, everybody. I think we can draw this to a close now, can we? And hope you've all got some things to think about, at least, anyway. Yeah. And as I said, in the chat,